Reba McLean woke at 9 and heard his steady breathing. She stretched lazily in the big bed. He didn't stir. She reviewed the layout of the house, the order of rugs and floor, the direction of the ticking clock. When she had it straight, she rose quietly and found the bathroom. After her long shower, he was still asleep. Her torn underclothes were on the floor. She found them with her feet and stuffed them in her purse. She pulled her cotton dress on over her head, picked up her cane, and walked outside. He had told her the yard was large and level, bounded by hedges grown wild, but she was cautious at first. The morning breeze was cool, the sun warm. She stood in the yard and let the wind toss the seed heads of the elderberry through her hands. The wind found the creases of her body fresh from the shower. She raised her arms to it, and the wind blew cool beneath her breasts and arms and between her legs. Bees went by. She was not afraid of them, and they left her alone. Dollarhide woke, puzzled for an instant because he was not in his room upstairs. His yellow eyes grew wide as he remembered. An owlish turn of his head to the other pillow. Empty. Was she wandering around the house? What might she find? Or had something happened in the night? Something to clean up? He would be suspected. He might have to run. He looked in the bathroom, in the kitchen, down in the basement where his other wheelchair stood. The upper floor. He didn't want to go upstairs. He had to look. His tattoo flexed as he climbed the stairs. The dragon glowed at him from the picture in his bedroom. He could not stay in the room with the dragon. From an upstairs window, he spotted her in the yard. "Francis!" He knew the voice came from his room. He knew it was the voice of the dragon. This new tuneness with the dragon disoriented him. He first felt it when he put his hand on Reba's heart. The dragon had never spoken to him before. It was frightening. "Francis, come here." He tried to shut out the voice calling him as he hurried down the stairs. What could she have found? Grandmother's teeth had rattled in the glass, but he put them away when he brought her water. She couldn't see anything. Freddy's tape. It was in a cassette recorder in the parlor. He checked it. The cassette was rewound to the beginning. He couldn't remember if he had rewound it after he played it on the telephone to the tattler. She must not come back in the house. He didn't know what might happen in the house. She might get a surprise. The dragon might come down. He knew how easily she would tear. The women saw her getting in his van. Warfield would remember them together. Hurriedly, he dressed. Reba McLean felt the cool bark of a tree trunk's shadow, and then the sun again as she wandered across the yard. She could always tell where she was by the heat of the sun and the hum of the window air conditioner. Navigation, her life's discipline, was easy here. She turned around and around, trailing her hands on the shrubs and overgrown flowers. A cloud blocked the sun, and she stopped, not knowing in which direction she faced. She listened for the air conditioner. It was off. She felt a moment of uneasiness, then clapped her hands and heard the reassuring echo from the house. Reba flipped up her watch crystal and felt the time. She'd have to wake Dee soon. She needed to go home. The screen door slammed. "Good morning," she said. His keys tinkled as he came across the grass. He approached her cautiously, as though the wind of his coming might blow her down, and saw that she was not afraid of him. She didn't seem embarrassed or ashamed of what they had done in the night. She didn't seem angry. She didn't run from him or threaten him. He wondered if it was because she had not seen his private parts. Reba put her arms around him and laid her head on his hard chest. His heart was going fast. He managed to say, "Good morning." "I've had a really terrific time, Dee." "Really? What would someone say back?" "Good. Me too." That seemed all right. "Get her away from here." "But I need to go home now," she was saying. "My sister's coming by to pick me up for lunch. You could come too if you like." "I have to go to the plant," he said, modifying the lie he had ready.
"I'll get my purse."
"Oh, no, I'll get it." Almost blind to his own true feelings, no more able to express them than a scar can blush, Dollarhide did not know what had happened to him with Reba McLean, or why. He was confused, spiked with new fright at being two. She threatened him. She did not threaten him. There was the matter of her startling live movements of acceptance in grandmother's bed. Often Dollarhide did not find out what he felt until he acted. He didn't know how he felt toward Reba McLean. An ugly incident as he drove her home enlightened him a little. Just past the Lindbergh Boulevard exit off Interstate 70, Dollarhide pulled into a Servco Supreme station to fill his van. The attendant was a heavy-set, sullen man with Muscatel on his breath. He made a face when Dollarhide asked him to check the oil. The van was a quart low. The attendant jammed the oil spout into the can and stuck the spout into the engine. Dollarhide climbed out to pay. The attendant seemed enthusiastic about wiping the windshield, the passenger side of the windshield. He wiped and wiped. Reba McLean sat in the high bucket seat, her legs crossed, her skirt riding up over her knee. Her white cane lay between the seats. The attendant started over on the windshield. He was looking up her dress. Dollarhide glanced up from his wallet and caught him. He reached in through the window of the van and turned the wipers on high speed, batting the attendant's fingers.
"Hey, watch that!"
The attendant got busy removing the oil can from the engine compartment. He knew he was caught, and he wore a sly grin until Dollarhide came around the van to him.
"You son of a bitch!"
Fast over the S.
"What the hell's the matter with you?"
The attendant was about Dollarhide's height and weight, but he had nowhere near the muscle. He was young to have dentures, and he didn't take care of them. Their greenness disgusted Dollarhide. "What happened to your teeth?" he asked softly.
"What's it to you?"
"Did you pull them for your boyfriend, you rotten prick?" Dollarhide stood too close.
"Get the hell away from me!"
Quietly, "Pig. Idiot. Trash. Fool." With a one-hand shove, Dollarhide sent him flying back to slam against the van. The oil can and spout clattered on the asphalt. Dollarhide picked it up. "Don't run. I can catch you." He pulled the spout from the can and looked at its sharp end. The attendant was pale. There was something in Dollarhide's face that he had never seen before, anywhere. For a red instant, Dollarhide saw the spout jammed in the man's chest, draining his heart. He saw Reba's face through the windshield. She was shaking her head, saying something. She was trying to find the handle to roll her window down. "Ever had anything broken, ass eyes?" The attendant shook his head fast.
"I didn't mean no offense now, honest to God."
Dollarhide held the curved metal spout in front of the man's face. He held it in both hands, and his chest muscles bunched as he bent it double. He pulled out the man's waistband and dropped the spout down the front of his pants.
"Keep your pig eyes to yourself."
He stuffed money for the gas in the man's shirt pocket.
"You can run now," he said, "but I could catch you any time."
Chapter 36. The tape came on Saturday in a small package addressed to Will Graham, care of FBI Headquarters, Washington. It had been mailed in Chicago on the day Lowndes was killed. The laboratory and Leighton prints found nothing useful on the cassette case or the wrapper. A copy of the tape went to Chicago in the afternoon pouch. Special Agent Chester brought it to Graham in the jury room at mid-afternoon. A memo from Lloyd Bowman was attached. Voice prints verify this is Lowndes. Obviously, he was repeating dictation. It's a new tape, manufactured in the last 3 months and never used before. Behavioral science is picking at the content. Dr. Bloom should hear it when he's well enough. You decide about that. Clearly, the killer's trying to rattle you. He'll do that once too often, I think. A dry vote of confidence. Much appreciated. Graham knew he had to listen to the tape. He waited until Chester left. He didn't want to be closed up in the jury room with it. The empty courtroom was better. Some sun came in the tall windows. The cleaning women had been in, and dust still hung in the sunlight. The tape recorder was small and gray. Graham put it on a council table and pushed the button. A technician's monotone. Case number 426238, item 814, tagged and logged, a tape cassette. This is a re-recording. A shift in the quality of the sound. Graham held on to the railing of the jury box with both hands. Freddie Lowndes sounded tired and frightened. "I have had a great privilege. I have seen with wonder and awe, the strength of the great red dragon." The original recording had been interrupted frequently as it was made. The machine caught the clack of the stop key each time. Graham saw the finger on the key. Dragon finger. "I lied about him. All I wrote was lies from Will Graham. He made me write them. I have blasphemed against the dragon. Even so, the dragon is merciful. Now I want to serve him. He has helped me understand. His splendor and I will praise him. Newspapers, when you print this, always capitalize the H in him. He knows you made me lie, Will Graham, because I was forced to lie. He will be more merciful to me than to you, Will Graham. Reach behind you, Will Graham, and feel for the small knobs on the top of your pelvis. Feel your spine between them. That is the precise spot where the dragon will snap your spine." Graham kept his hands on the railing. "Damn if I'll feel." Did the dragon not know the nomenclature of the iliac spine, or did he choose not to use it? "There's much for you to dread. From my own lips, you'll learn a little more to dread." A pause before the awful screaming. Worse, the blubbering, lipless cry.
"You goddamn bastard, you promised!"
Graham put his head between his knees until the bright spots stopped dancing in front of his eyes. He opened his mouth and breathed deep. An hour passed before he could listen to it again. He took the recorder into the jury room and tried to listen there. Too close. He left the tape recorder turning and went back into the courtroom. He could hear through the open door.
"I have had a great privilege."
Someone was at the courtroom door. Graham recognized the young clerk from the Chicago FBI office and motioned for him to come in.
"A letter came for you," the clerk said. "Mr. Chester sent me with it. He told me to be sure and say the postal inspector fluoroscoped it."
The clerk pulled a letter out of his breast pocket. Heavy mauve stationery. Graham hoped it was from Molly. "It's stamped, see?" "Thank you." "Also, it's payday." The clerk handed him his check. On the tape, Freddie screamed. The young man flinched. "Sorry," Graham said.
"I don't see how you stand it,"
the young man said. "Go home,"
Graham said.
He sat in the jury box to read his letter. He wanted some relief. The letter was from Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
Dear Will, a brief note of congratulations for the job you did on Mr. Lowndes. I admired it enormously. What a cunning boy you are. Mr. Lowndes often offended me with his ignorant drivel, but he did enlighten me on one thing, your confinement in the mental hospital. My inept attorney should have brought that out in court, but never mind. You know, Will, you worry too much. You'd be so much more comfortable if you relaxed with yourself. We don't invent our natures, Will. They're issued to us along with our lungs and pancreas and everything else. Why fight it? I want to help you, Will, and I'd like to start by asking you this. When you were so depressed after you shot Mr. Garrett Jacob Hobbs to death, it wasn't the act that got you down, was it? Really? Didn't you feel so bad because killing him felt so good? Think about it, but don't worry about it. Why shouldn't it feel good? It must feel good to God. He does it all the time. And are we not made in His image? You may have noticed in the paper yesterday, God dropped a church roof on 34 of His worshippers in Texas Wednesday night, just as they were groveling through a hymn. Don't you think that felt good? 34. He'd let you have Hobbs. He got 160 Filipinos in one plane crash last week. He'll let you have measly Hobbs. He won't begrudge you one measly murder. Two now. That's all right. Watch the papers. God always stays ahead. Best, Hannibal Lecter, M.D. Graham knew that Lecter was dead wrong about Hobbs, but for a half second, he wondered if Lecter might be a little bit right in the case of Freddie Lowndes. The enemy inside Graham agreed with any accusation. He had put his hand on Freddie's shoulder in the Tatler photograph to establish that he really had told Freddie those insulting things about the dragon. Or had he wanted to put Freddie at risk just a little? He wondered. The certain knowledge that he would not knowingly miss a chance at the dragon reprieved him. "I'm just about worn out with you crazy sons of bitches," Graham said aloud. He wanted a break. He called Molly, but no one answered the telephone at Willie's grandparents' house. "Probably out in their damned motorhome," he mumbled. He went out for coffee, partly to assure himself that he was not hiding in the jury room. In the window of a jewelry store, he saw a delicate antique gold bracelet. It cost him most of his paycheck. He had it wrapped and stamped for mailing. Only when he was sure he was alone at the mail drop did he address it to Molly in Oregon. Graham did not realize, as Molly did, that he gave presents when he was angry. He didn't want to go back to his jury room and work, but he had to. The thought of Valerie Leeds spurred him. "I'm sorry, I can't come to the phone right now," Valerie Leeds had said. He wished that he had known her. He wished. Useless, childish thought. Graham was tired, selfish, resentful, fatigued to a child-minded state in which his standards of measurement were the first ones he learned, where the direction north was Highway 61, and 6 feet was forever the length of his father. He made himself settle down to the minutely detailed victim profile he was putting together from a fan of reports and his own observations. Affluence. That was one parallel. Both families were affluent. Odd that Valerie Leeds saved money on pantyhose. Graham wondered if she had been a poor child. He thought so. Her own children were a little too well turned out. Graham had been a poor child, following his father from the boatyards in Biloxi and Greenville to the lake boats on Erie. Always the new boy at school, always the stranger. He had a half-buried grudge against the rich. Valerie Leeds might have been a poor child. He was tempted to watch his film of her again. He could do it in the courtroom. No, the Leedses were not his immediate problem. He knew the Leedses. He did not know the Jacobys. His lack of intimate knowledge about the Jacobys plagued him. The house fire in Detroit had taken everything, family albums, probably diaries too. Graham tried to know them through the objects they wanted, bought, and used. That was all he had. The Jacoby probate file was 3 inches thick, and a lot of it was lists of possessions, a new household outfitted since the move to Birmingham. Look at all this shit. It was all insured, listed with serial numbers, as the insurance companies required. Trust a man who has been burned out to buy plenty of insurance for the next time. The attorney, Byron Metcalf, had sent him carbons instead of Xerox copies of the insurance declarations. The carbons were fuzzy and hard to read. Jacoby had a ski boat. Leeds had a ski boat. Jacoby had a three-wheeler. Leeds had a trail bike. Graham licked his thumb and turned the page. The fourth item on the second page was a Chinon Pacific movie projector. Graham stopped. How had he missed it? He had looked through every crate on every pallet in the Birmingham warehouse, alert for anything that would give him an intimate view of the Jacobys. Where was the projector? He could cross-check this insurance declaration against the inventory Byron Metcalf had prepared as executor when he stored the Jacobys' things. The items had been checked off by the warehouse supervisor who signed the storage contract. It took 15 minutes to go down the list of stored items. No projector, no camera, no film. Graham leaned back in his chair and stared at the Jacobys, smiling from the picture propped before him. What the hell did you do with it? Was it stolen? Did the killer steal it? If the killer stole it, did he fence it? Dear God, give me a traceable fence. Graham wasn't tired anymore. He wanted to know if anything else was missing. He looked for an hour, comparing the warehouse storage inventory with the insurance declarations. Everything was accounted for, except the small precious items. They should all be on Byron Metcalf's own lockbox list of things he had put in the bank vault in Birmingham. All of them were on the list, except two. Crystal oddment box, 4 inches by 3 inches, sterling silver lid, appeared on the insurance declaration, but was not in the lockbox. Sterling picture frame, 9 by 11 inches, worked with vines and flowers, wasn't in the vault either. Stolen? Mislaid. They were small items, easily concealed. Usually, fenced silver is melted down immediately. It would be hard to trace. But movie equipment had serial numbers inside and out. It could be traced. Was the killer the thief? As he stared at his stained photograph of the Jacobys, Graham felt the sweet jolt of a new connection. But when he saw the answer whole, it was seedy and disappointing and small. There was a telephone in the jury room. Graham called Birmingham Homicide. He got the 3-to-11 watch commander. In the Jacoby case, I noticed you kept an in-and-out log at the house after it was sealed off, right? Let me get somebody to look, the watch commander said. Graham knew they kept one. It was good procedure to record every person entering or leaving a murder scene, and Graham had been pleased to see that Birmingham did it. He waited 5 minutes before a clerk picked up the telephone. Okay, in and out. What do you want to know? Is Niles Jacoby, son of the deceased, is he on it? Yep, July 2nd, 7 p.m. He had permission to get personal items.
Did he have a suitcase, does it say?
Nope. Sorry.
Byron Metcalf's voice was husky and his breathing heavy when he answered the telephone. Graham wondered what he was doing.
Hope I didn't disturb you.
What can I do for you, Will?
I need a little help with Niles Jacoby.
What's he done now?
I think he lifted a few things out of the Jacoby house after they were killed. There's a sterling picture frame missing from your lockbox inventory. When I was in Birmingham, I picked up a loose photograph of the family in Niles' dormitory room. It used to be in a frame. I can see the impression the mat left on it.
A little bastard. I gave permission for him to get his clothes and some books he needed, Metcalf said.
Niles has expensive friendships. This is mainly what I'm after, though. A movie projector and a movie camera are missing, too. I want to know if he got them. Probably he did, but if he didn't, maybe the killer got them.
In that case, we need to get the serial numbers out to the hawk shops. We need to put them on the national hot sheet. The frame's probably melted down by now.
He'll think frame when I get through with him.
One thing, if Niles took the projector, he might have kept the film. He couldn't get anything for it.
I want the film. I need to see it. If you come at him from the front, he'll deny everything and flush the film if he has any.
Okay, Metcalf said. His car title reverted to the estate. I'm executor, so I can search it without a warrant. My friend the judge won't mind paper in his room for me. I'll call you.
Graham went back to work. Affluence. Put affluence in the profile the police would use.
Graham wondered if Mrs. Leeds and Mrs. Jacoby ever did their marketing in tennis clothes. That was a fashionable thing to do in some areas. It was a dumb thing to do in some areas because it was doubly provocative, arousing class resentment and lust at the same time.
Graham imagined them pushing grocery carts, short pleated skirts brushing the brown thighs, the little balls on their sweat socks winking, passing the husky man with the barracuda eyes who was buying cold lunch meat to gnaw in his car. How many families were there, with three children and a pet, and only common locks between them and the dragon as they slept? When Graham pictured possible victims, he saw clever, successful people in graceful houses. But the next person to confront the dragon did not have children or a pet, and there was no grace in his house. The next person to confront the dragon was Francis Dollarhide.
Chapter 37. The thump of weights on the attic floor carried through the old house. Dollarhide was lifting, straining, pumping more weight than he had ever lifted. His costume was different. Sweatpants covered his tattoo. The sweatshirt hung over the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun. The kimono hung on the wall like the shed skin of a tree snake. It covered the mirror. Dollarhide wore no mask. Up 280 pounds from the floor to his chest in one heave. Now over his head.
Whom are you thinking about?
Startled by the voice, he nearly dropped the weight, swayed beneath it. Down. The plates thudded and clanked on the floor. He turned, his great arms hanging, and stared in the direction of the voice.
Whom are you thinking about?
It seemed to come from behind the sweatshirt, but its rasp and volume hurt his throat.
Whom are you thinking about?
He knew who spoke, and he was frightened. From the beginning, he and the dragon had been one. He was becoming, and the dragon was his higher self. Their bodies, voices, wills were one. Not now. Not since Reba. Don't think Reba.
Who is acceptable? the dragon asked. Mrs. Sherman,
it was hard for Dolarhyde to say.
Speak up. I can't understand you. Whom are you thinking about?
Dolarhyde, his face set, turned to the barbell.
Up, over his head, much harder this time. Mrs. Erman wet in the water. You think about your little buddy, don't you? You want her to be your little buddy, don't you?
The weight came down with a thud.
I don't have a little buddy.
With the fear, his speech was failing. He had to occlude his nostrils with his upper lip.
A stupid lie!
The dragon's voice was strong and clear. He said the S's without effort.
You forget the becoming. Prepare for the Shermans. Lift the weight.
Dolarhyde seized the barbell and strained. His mind strained with his body. Desperately, he tried to think of the Shermans. He forced himself to think of the weight of Mrs. Sherman in his arms. Mrs. Sherman was next. It was Mrs. Sherman. He was fighting Mr. Sherman in the dark, holding him down until loss of blood made Sherman's heart quiver like a bird. It was the only heart he heard. He didn't hear Reba's heart. He didn't. Fear leached his strength. He got the weight up to his thighs, could not make the turn up to his chest. He thought of the Shermans ranged around him, eyes wide, as he took the dragon's due. It was no good. It was hollow, empty. The weight thudded down.
Not acceptable. Mrs. You can't even say Mrs. Sherman. You never intend to take the Shermans. You want Reba McLean. You want her to be your little buddy, don't you? You want to be friends.
No.
Lie.
Just for a little while.
Just for a little while? You sniveling hare-lip. Who would be friends with you? Come here. I'll show you what you are.
Dolarhyde did not move.
I've never seen a child as disgusting and dirty as you. Come here.
He went.
Take down the sweatshirt.
He took it down.
Look at me.
The dragon glowed from the wall.
Take down the kimono. Look in the mirror.
He looked. He could not help himself or turn his face from the scalding light. He saw himself drool.
Look at yourself. I'm going to give you a surprise for your little buddy. Take off that rag.
Dolarhyde's hands fought each other at the waistband of the sweatpants. The sweatpants tore. He stripped them away from him with his right hand, held the rags to him with his left. His right hand snatched the rags away from his trembling, failing left. He threw them into the corner and fell back on the mat, curling on himself like a lobster split live. He hugged himself and groaned, breathing hard, his tattoo brilliant in the harsh gym lights.
I've never seen a child as disgusting and dirty as you. Go get them.
Hey, Ma.
Get them.
He padded from the room and returned with the dragon's teeth.
Put them in your palms. Lock your fingers and squeeze my teeth together.
Dolarhyde's pectoral muscles bunched.
You know how they can snap. Now, hold them under your belly. Hold yourself between the teeth.
No!
Do it! Now look!
The teeth were beginning to hurt him.
Spit and tears fell on his chest.
"Mleeds!"
"You are awful, left behind in the becoming. You are awful, and I will name you. You are Cuntface. Say it."
"I am Cuntface."
He occluded his nostrils with his lip to say the words. "Soon I will be cleansed of you," the dragon said effortlessly. "Will that be good?"
"Good.
Who will be next when it is time?"
"Mrs. Erman."
Sharp pain shot through Dollarhide, pain and terrible fear. "I'll tear it off."
"Reba, Reba, I'll give you Reba."
Already his speech was improving. "You'll give me nothing. She is mine. They are all mine. Reba McLean and then the Shermans."
"Reba and then the Shermans. The law will know."
"I have provided for that day. Do you doubt it?"
"No."
"Who are you?"
"Cuntface."
"You may put away my teeth. You pitiful, weak hare lip. You'd keep your little buddy from me, would you? I'll tear her apart and rub the pieces in your ugly face. I'll hang you with her large intestine if you oppose me. You know I can. Put £300 on the bar." Dollarhide added the plates to the bar. He had never lifted as much as 280 until today. "Lift it." If he were not as strong as the dragon, Reba would die. He knew it. He strained until the room turned red before his bulging eyes.
"I can't."
"No, you can't, but I can." Dollarhide gripped the bar. It bowed as the weight rose to his shoulders. Up, above his head, easily. "Goodbye, Cuntface," he said. "Proud dragon, quivering in the light." Chapter 38 Francis Dollarhide never got to work on Monday morning. He started from his house exactly on time, as he always did. His appearance was impeccable, his driving precise. He put on his dark glasses when he made the turn at the Missouri River Bridge and drove into the morning sun. His styrofoam cooler squeaked as it jiggled against the passenger seat. He leaned across and set it on the floor, remembering that he must pick up the dry ice and get the film from... Crossing the Missouri Channel now, moving water under him. He looked at the whitecaps on the sliding river and suddenly felt that he was sliding and the river was still. A strange, disjointed, collapsing feeling flooded him. He let up on the accelerator. The van slowed in the outside lane and stopped. Traffic behind him was stacking up, honking. He didn't hear it. He sat, sliding slowly northward over the still river, facing the morning sun. Tears leaked from beneath his sunglasses and fell hot on his forearms. Someone was pecking on the window. A driver, face early morning pale and puffed with sleep, had gotten out of a car behind him. The driver was yelling something through the window. Dollarhide looked at the man. Flashing blue lights were coming from the other end of the bridge. He knew he should drive. He asked his body to step on the gas, and it did. The man beside the van skipped backward to save his feet. Dollarhide pulled into the parking lot of a big motel near the U.S. 270 interchange. A school bus was parked in the lot, the bell of a tuba leaning against its back window. Dollarhide wondered if he was supposed to get on the bus with the old people. No, that wasn't it. He looked around for his mother's Packard. "Get in. Don't put your feet on the seat," his mother said. That wasn't it either. He was in a motel parking lot on the west side of St. Louis, and he wanted to be able to choose, and he couldn't. In 6 days, if he could wait that long, he would kill Reba McLean. He made a sudden high sound through his nose. Maybe the dragon would be willing to take the Shermans first and wait another moon. No, he wouldn't. Reba McLean didn't know about the dragon. She thought she was with Francis Dolarhyde. She wanted to put her body on Francis Dolarhyde. She welcomed Francis Dolarhyde in grandmother's bed. "I've had a really terrific time, Dee," Reba McLean said in the yard. Maybe she liked Francis Dolarhyde. That was a perverted, despicable thing for a woman to do. He understood that he should despise her for it, but oh God, it was good. Reba McLean was guilty of liking Francis Dolarhyde, demonstrably guilty. If it weren't for the power of his becoming, if it weren't for the dragon, he could never have taken her to his house. He would not have been capable of sex. Or would he? "My God, man, that's so sweet." That's what she said. She said, "Man." The breakfast crowd was coming out of the motel, passing his van. Their idle glances walked on him with many tiny feet. He needed to think. He couldn't go home. He checked into the motel, called his office, and reported himself sick. The room he got was bland and quiet. The only decorations were bad steamboat prints. Nothing glowed from the walls. Dolarhyde lay down in his clothes. The ceiling had sparkling flecks in the plaster. Every few minutes he had to get up and urinate. He shivered. Then he sweated. An hour passed. He did not want to give Reba McLean to the dragon. He thought about what the dragon would do to him if he didn't serve her up. Intense fear comes in waves. The body can't stand it for long at a time. In the heavy calm between the waves, Dolarhyde could think, how could he keep from giving her to the dragon? One way kept nudging him. He got up. The light switch clacked loud in the tiled bathroom. Dolarhyde looked at the shower curtain rod, a solid piece of 1-inch pipe bolted to the bathroom walls. He took down the shower curtain and hung it over the mirror. Grasping the pipe, he chinned himself with one arm, his toes dragging up the side of the bathtub. It was stout enough. His belt was stout enough, too. He could make himself do it. He wasn't afraid of that. He tied the end of his belt around the pipe in a bowline knot. The buckle end formed a noose. The thick belt didn't swing. It hung down in a stiff noose. He sat on the toilet lid and looked at it. He wouldn't get any drop, but he could stand it. He could keep his hands off the noose until he was too weak to raise his arms. But how could he be positive that his death would affect the dragon, now that he and the dragon were two? Maybe it wouldn't. How could he be sure the dragon then would leave her alone? It might be days before they found his body. She would wonder where he was. In that time, would she go to his house and feel around for him? Go upstairs and feel around for him and get a surprise? The great red dragon would take an hour spitting her down the stairs. Should he call her and warn her? What could she do against him, even warned? Nothing. She could hope to die quickly, hope that in his rage he would quickly bite deep enough. Upstairs in Dolarhyde's house, the dragon waited in pictures he had framed with his own hands.
The dragon waited in art books and magazines beyond number, reborn every time a photographer did what? Dolarhyde could hear in his mind the dragon's powerful voice cursing Reba. He would curse her first before he bit. He would curse Dolarhyde too, tell her he was nothing.
"Don't do that! Don't do that!"
Dolarhyde said to the echoing tile. He listened to his voice, the voice of Francis Dolarhyde, the voice that Reba McLean understood easily, his own voice. He had been ashamed of it all his life, had said bitter and vicious things to others with it. But he had never heard the voice of Francis Dolarhyde curse him.
"Don't do that!"
The voice he heard now had never, ever cursed him. It had repeated the dragon's abuse. The memory shamed him. He probably was not much of a man, he thought. It occurred to him that he had never really found out about that, and now he was curious. He had one rag of pride that Reba McLean had given him. It told him dying in a bathroom was a sorry end. What else? What other way was there? There was a way. And when it came to him, it was blasphemy, he knew. But it was a way. He paced the motel room, paced between the beds and from the door to the windows. As he walked, he practiced speaking. The words came out all right if he breathed deep between the sentences and didn't hurry. He could talk very well between the rushes of fear. Now he had a bad one. He had one that made him wretch. A calm was coming after. He waited for it, and when it came, he hurried to the telephone and placed a call to Brooklyn. A junior high school band was getting on the bus in the motel parking lot. The children saw Dolarhyde coming. He had to go through them to get to his van. A fat, round-faced boy, with his Sam Brown belt all crooked, put on a scowl, puffed up his chest, and flexed his biceps after Dolarhyde passed. Two girls giggled. The tuba blatted out the bus window as Dolarhyde went by, and he never heard the laughter behind him. In 20 minutes, he stopped the van in the lane 300 yards from Grandmother's house. He mopped his face, inhaled deeply 3 or 4 times. He gripped his house key in his left hand, the steering wheel with his right. A high keening sounded through his nose, and again, louder, louder, louder again. Go! Gravel showered behind the van as it shot forward, the house bouncing bigger in the windshield. The van slid sideways into the yard, and Dolarhyde was out of it, running. Inside, not looking left or right, pounding down the basement stairs, fumbling at the padlocked trunk in the basement, looking at his keys. The trunk keys were upstairs. He didn't give himself time to think. A high humming through his nose as loud as he could to numb thought, drown out voices as he climbed the stairs at a run. At the bureau now, fumbling in the drawer for the keys, not looking at the picture of the dragon at the foot of the bed.
"What are you doing?"
Where were the keys? Where were the keys?
"What are you doing? Stop! I've never seen a child as disgusting and dirty as you. Stop!"
His searching hands slowed.
"Look! Look at me!"
He gripped the edge of the bureau, tried not to turn to the wall. He cut his eyes painfully away as his head turned in spite of him.
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing."
The telephone was ringing. Telephone ringing. Telephone ringing. He picked it up, his back to the picture.
"Hey, Dee," How are you feeling?
Reba McLean's voice. He cleared his throat. Okay. Hardly a whisper.
I tried to call you down here. Your office said you were sick.
You sound terrible. Talk to me.
Well, of course I'll talk to you. What do you think I called you for? What's wrong?
Flu, he said. Are you going to the doctor? Hello?
I said, are you going to the doctor?
Talk loud.
He scrabbled in the drawer, tried the drawer next to it.
Have we got a bad connection, Dee? You shouldn't be there sick by yourself. Tell her to come over tonight and take care of you.
Dollarhide almost got his hand over the mouthpiece in time.
My God, what was that? Is somebody with you? The radio. I grabbed the wrong knob.
Hey, Dee, do you want me to send somebody? You don't sound so hot. I'll come myself. I'll get Marcia to bring me at lunch.
No.
The keys were under a belt coiled in the drawer. He had them now. He backed into the hall, carrying the telephone.
Okay. I'll see you soon.
The S's nearly foundered him. He ran down the stairs. The phone cord jerked out of the wall, and the telephone tumbled down the stairs behind him.
A scream of savage rage. Come here, cunt face!
Down in the basement, in the trunk, beside his case of dynamite, was a small valise packed with cash, credit cards, and driver's licenses in various names, his pistol, knife, and blackjack. He grabbed the valise and ran up to the ground floor, quickly past the stairs, ready to fight if the dragon came down them. Into the van, and driving hard, fishtailing in the gravel lane. He slowed on the highway and pulled over to the shoulder to heave yellow bile. Some of the fear went away. Proceeding at legal speed, using his flashers well ahead of turns, carefully, he drove to the airport. Chapter 39 Dollarhide paid his taxi fare in front of an apartment house on Eastern Parkway, 2 blocks from the Brooklyn Museum. He walked the rest of the way. Joggers passed him, heading for Prospect Park. Standing on the traffic island near the IRT subway station, he got a good view of the Greek Revival building. He had never seen the Brooklyn Museum before, though he had read its guidebook. He had ordered the book when he first saw Brooklyn Museum in tiny letters beneath photographs of the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun. The names of the great thinkers, from Confucius to Demosthenes, were carved in stone above the entrance. It was an imposing building, with botanical gardens beside it, a fitting house for the dragon. The subway rumbled beneath the street, tingling the soles of his feet. Stale air puffed from the gratings and mixed with the smell of the dye in his mustache. Only an hour left before closing time. He crossed the street and went inside. The checkroom attendant took his valise.
"Will the check room be open tomorrow?" he asked.
"The museum's closed tomorrow." The attendant was a wizened woman in a blue smock. She turned away from him.
"The people who come in tomorrow, do they use the check room?"
"No, the museum's closed. The check room's closed."
"Good. Thank you.
Don't mention it." Dollarhide cruised among the great glass cases in the Oceanic Hall and the Hall of the Americas on the ground floor. Andes pottery, primitive edged weapons, artifacts and powerful masks from the Indians of the northwest coast. Now there were only 40 minutes left before the museum closed. There was no more time to learn the ground floor. He knew where the exits and the public elevators were. He rode up to the 5th floor. He could feel that he was closer to the dragon now. But it was all right. He wouldn't turn a corner and run into him. The dragon was not on public display. The painting had been locked away in the dark since its return from the Tate Gallery in London. Dolarhyde had learned on the telephone that the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun was rarely displayed. It was almost 200 years old, and a watercolor. Light would fade it. Dolarhyde stopped in front of Albert Bierstadt's A Storm in the Rocky Mountains, Mount Rosalie, 1866. From there, he could see the locked doors of the painting, study, and storage department. That's where the dragon was. Not a copy, not a photograph. The dragon. This is where he would come tomorrow, when he had his appointment. He walked around the perimeter of the fifth floor, past the corridor of portraits, seeing nothing of the paintings. The exits were what interested him. He found the fire exits and the main stairs, and marked the location of the public elevators. The guards were polite, middle-aged men in thick-soled shoes, years of standing in the set of their legs. None was armed, Dolarhyde noted. One of the guards in the lobby was armed. Maybe he was a moonlighting cop. The announcement of closing time came over the public address system, and he went to get his valise. Dolarhyde stood on the pavement under the allegorical figure of Brooklyn and watched the crowd come out into the pleasant summer evening. Joggers ran in place, waiting while the stream of people crossed the sidewalk toward the subway. Dolarhyde spent a few minutes in the botanical gardens. Then he flagged a taxi and gave the driver the address of a store he had found in the Yellow Pages. Chapter 40. At 9 p.m. Monday, Graham set his briefcase on the floor outside the Chicago apartment he was using and rooted in his pocket for the keys. He had spent a long day in Detroit, interviewing staff and checking employment records at a hospital where Mrs. Jacoby did volunteer work before the family moved to Birmingham. He was looking for a drifter, someone who might have worked in both Detroit and Atlanta, or in Birmingham and Atlanta. Someone with access to a van and a wheelchair, who saw Mrs. Jacoby and Mrs. Leeds before he broke into their houses. Crawford thought the trip was a waste of time, but humored him. Crawford had been right. Damn Crawford, he was right too much. Graham could hear the telephone ringing in the apartment. The keys caught in the lining of his pocket. When he jerked them out, a long thread came with them. Change spilled down the inside of the trouser leg and scattered on the floor. Son of a bitch. He made it halfway across the room before the phone stopped ringing. Maybe that was Molly trying to reach him. He called her in Oregon. Willie's grandfather answered the telephone with his mouth full. It was supper time in Oregon. "Just ask Molly to call me when she's finished," Graham told him. He was in the shower with shampoo in his eyes when the telephone rang again. He sluiced his head and went dripping to grab the receiver. "Hello, Hot Lips."
"You silver-tongued devil. This is Byron Metcalf in Birmingham."
"Sorry.
I've got good news and bad news. You were right about Niles Jacoby. He took the stuff out of the house. He'd gotten rid of it, but I squeezed him with some hash that was in his room, and he owned up. That's the bad news. I know you hoped the Tooth Fairy stole it and fenced it. The good news is there's some film. I don't have it yet. Niles says there are two reels stuffed under the seat in his car. You still want it, right?"
"Sure, sure I do."
"Well, his intimate friend Randy is using the car, and we haven't caught up with him yet, but it won't be long. Want me to put the film on the first plane to Chicago and call you when it's coming?"
"Please do. That's good, Byron. Thanks."
"Nothing to it."
Molly called just as Graham was drifting off to sleep. After they assured each other that they were all right, there didn't seem to be much to say. Willie was having a real good time, Molly said. She let Willie say good night. Willie had plenty more to say than just good night. He told Will the exciting news. Grandpa bought him a pony. Molly hadn't mentioned it. Chapter 41. The Brooklyn Museum is closed to the general public on Tuesdays, but art classes and researchers are admitted. The museum is an excellent facility for serious scholarship. The staff members are knowledgeable and accommodating. Often, they allow researchers to come by appointment on Tuesdays to see items not on public display. Francis Dollarhide came out of the IRT subway station shortly after 2 p.m. on Tuesday, carrying his scholarly materials. He had a notebook, a Tate Gallery catalog, and a biography of William Blake under his arm. He had